Yesterday, the world joined in shared grief as Notre Dame burned. Rightly so. It's a perfect realisation of the architecture of the time and the skills of those who spent an astonishing 100 years building it. As a major tourist attraction, the simple fact of its fame guarantees heaven and earth will be moved to restore it. Its value isn't questioned. Nestled in the Dampier Archipelago is a much less famous example of art, skill, history, and hallowed ground. As you head out on the Burrup Peninsula, the rock formations take on a shape that almost look like mine tailings. On those rocks, a vast collection of Aboriginal engravings, intricate and skilled. It's been described as the largest outdoor art gallery on the planet. The carvings tell the story of 50,000 years of human existence. It's estimated there are a million of them. And yet the sad fact is, most of us know more about the French engravings of horses at Lascaux than we do of what exists on our doorstep. The Aboriginal people of the Pilbara know the site as Murujuga. And while sites like Lascaux are heavily protected, the rock art of the Burrup remains caught in a decades-long fight between culture, tourism and industry. Within a stone's throw of this incredible art, there are petrochemical plants, a giant gas hub and one of Australia's busiest ports. Think gleaming sprawls of pipes and emission stacks. But now, Aboriginal traditional custodians, archaeologists and government are finally working together to push for UNESCO World Heritage listing. Today on Focus, Murujuga, can industry and the rock art coexist? Joining today's discussion are Peter Jeffries, CEO of Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation in our Karratha studio, Dr. John Black, former CSIRO scientist and member of Friends of Australian Rock Art via our Sydney studio, and Dr. Ken Mulvaney, an archaeologist working at UWA's Centre for Rock Art Research, and Luke Blackburn, manager of government and external relations for Yarra, fertiliser plant in the Burrup. Peter, I'd like to start with you. Can you describe the rock art for us? What do you see when you step into Deep Gorge?
First of all, what I'd like to do is to set a little bit of context around Murujuga itself. Murujuga means hip bone sticking out in the local language. Is one of the Pilbara's best-kept secret and is bursting with untapped potential. Murujuga is the world's oldest living culture showcased within a pristine coastal environment. It has 42 islands, pristine white sands and beaches, and an abundance of marine life. It is located approximately 1,500 k's north of Perth in Western Australia. It has the largest collection of rock art anywhere in the world, up to and onwards in excess of 35,000 years old.
Peter, for people who haven't been there, can you tell us when you step into Deep Gorge, for instance, and you look around, what do you actually see? Describe for us what the rock art looks like.
As you said in your introduction, Joe, it is a collection of different sizes of panels, and it appears as if someone's placed the individual rocks or panels in the landscape on top of each other, forming the hills. And when you look at the rock, you can see, you know, some red, a little bit of black, and a little bit of ochre, red colour with regards to the red earth.
And what are the images of on the rocks, Peter?
Most of the art or the panel or the rocks have art on them. They are range from, you know, birds of different kind, spiritual beings, human beings, your turtles, your marine life, your that sort of stuff, your kangaroos, and also we have Tasmanian tigers and Tasmanian devils that have been depicted on the Burrup as well. There are also men and women, gender specific art as well.
And how many engravings, petroglyphs, are there?
There are over a million known recorded art.
Dr. Ken Mulvaney, I'll bring you in here. How valuable is this rock art?
It is very valuable in a global sense. Here, as Peter's touched on, there is the cultural value, the significance, the religious aspects of it. We've seen on the news for the last day the destruction that's occurred at Notre Dame. TV channels, radio stations have been running stories about that, and how devastating the destruction of that cultural heritage is. On the But upon Murujuga, we have rock art that is of equal artistic and religious importance as that place, yet for decades it has been destroyed and caused mere ripples of concern. The Aboriginal people, archaeologists in particular, have been fighting for decades. But what makes it so significant is we literally have probably the longest continual sequence of rock art production anywhere in the world, starting certainly before the last ice age, certainly on par with Lascaux and the French Paleolithic art, but people continued producing that art until European settlement in the area in the 1860s. But not only is that, this art actually traps or reflects the changes in the environmental conditions through those tens of thousands of years, but it also reflects the Aboriginal continuity of connection to place and to the spiritual landscape, to their ancestors. These are things that you find nowhere else in the world, yet this art is there literally on our doorstep, visible for all to see in a spectacular landscape.
And Peter mentioned there are images of the human form. Are those some of the earliest known images on rock art that we know about, or do you find those in Europe as well?
As far as we can tell, the rock art of Murujuga reflects an amazing artistic achievement very early on in human development. Humans don't appear in art anywhere else in the world for centuries, if not millennia, after it's appeared on the Burrup.
So how do you measure its worth?
It is irreplaceable. That is one measure. We are talking of a cultural productivity over tens of thousands of years that is still has a direct religious connection to a living people. That is unsurpassed anywhere else in the world. And it's of a place that is the images themselves. Unless you go there, you just cannot appreciate the sheer majesty of what is there.
Dr. John Black, when did you first see the rock art?
In 2010. I'll fill you in a little bit of background. I live in the Blue Mountains, and I spent a lot of my time with the Volunteer Bushfire Brigade. And so I spent a lot of time walking through the bush and saw rock art in the Blue Mountains, and it's quite magnificent here. And I was invited by friends from Canberra to go with Friends of Australian Rock Art in July 2010 to look at the rock art. And truly was blown away with what I saw. As the other two have said, it is totally magnificent. Nowhere do you see such beautiful art, and it is beautiful, and such variation, and haunting in a way. There are many figures there of the human face, pictures of the human face, and they look quite haunting and just magnificent. So it completely blew me away, and my wife, and many of us. And to look up and see the big industry that was there was quite incongruous, and made us feel quite uncomfortable. And so that sort of has led me on a path that I've continued for nearly the last 10 years.
And as you said, you live in the Blue Mountains, 3,680 kilometres away from this rock art. You're very passionate about protecting it. What have you done in that time to do so?
Look, it's a little bit of a story that that started shortly after I had seen the rock art, and that was July 2010. In September 2010, the state government put out for public comment on the development of ammonium nitrate plant there. And it just seemed to me that it was quite incongruous to build more industry there. So I started to read up on their application, because I wanted to put in a submission. And I kept finding they referred back to CSIRO reports, and there were three CSIRO reports. And from that, they concluded, this is the government and EPA, that there would be no impact on the rock art from the new industry. But when I looked at these reports, I was horrified as a scientist, because they were not done in what I would call a clear scientific method. They were making conclusions without statistical analysis, and part of the reason was that there were not enough replicates in the analyses, in the studies, to be able to make any significant conclusions. And when I looked at them, I could see that in one case they had repeated one piece of their research twice, and the values were so different between those two one pieces, and the CSIRO said that these were not different, but you couldn't say that because they actually didn't have enough treatment. So that led me on a long path of trying to get the data and analyze it. From doing that, we showed that, you know, a lot of what CSIRO had been saying was in fact not correct, and so that then made me wanted to get in and understand the chemistry behind it and what is likely to happen to the rock art over time.
John, we can get into that in a bit more detail in a moment. Let's talk for a minute about the World Heritage listing. Now, last month, Premier Mark McGowan announced the state government will back a nomination for the Burrup Peninsula to get UNESCO World Heritage listing.
This is a marvellous and beautiful area and deserves national and international recognition.
But with further industrial development flagged for the peninsula, can World Heritage listing be balanced with the need to protect the rock art and the needs of industry? Premier McGowan again.
Making sure they work together well is important, and making sure we have the highest environmental standards is very important.
So, Ken, going to you, this industry began in the 80s. What did you see happen back then?
Yeah, well, I first arrived up there in 1980 as an employee of the West Australian Museum, when we were tasked with recording the rock art prior to the development of the Karratha gas plant. Back then, no one really appreciated how rich this area was for its cultural heritage, apart from the local people. But their voice was not listened to. We had, obviously, Nookumbah just before then, when Charlie Court, when there was government push, when the Aboriginal people were trying to save sacred sites from oil exploration. It was a time when basically value was put on resource industry and not on cultural heritage. And when I arrived, we were literally working in front of the bulldozers trying to save what we could. Fortunately, things have changed, but I must admit, I thought when we discovered just how rich that was, and we recorded over 9,000 engravings, that's more in one location than many countries have in their whole collection of rock art. And we have now, with the university, been working with Murujuga, have recorded some 50,000 images as part of research programs. We know the area is dense with rock art. To have industry footprint will always impact on the cultural heritage that is there.
There are billions of dollars worth of infrastructure, thousands of jobs on the Burrup. I don't think we're going to see industry move, but what is currently operating there? There are a number of plants. John, can you talk us through who's operating? Woodside, Yarra?
Yes, that's right. Ken is probably better to be able to fill you in on all of them, but there are several Woodside plants. There's a gas plant and a liquefaction plant, and then there's the fertiliser plant that's run by Yarra and the ammonium nitrate plant that has recently started to be run by Yarra. But what's most disturbing is that the government is planning to put two more new large industries on there. One of them is a methanol plant, which is owned by or will be run by Coogee Chemicals with Wesfarmers and Mitsubishi, and the other is a very large urea plant, which is going to cost something like $1.4 billion to build. And we know from the previous applications that they have made that they are going to put into the atmosphere something like 500 tonnes of urea each year, and this could be devastating for the rock art.
And we have gone to the government to ask about those future proposals, but what's the actual problem with industry up there and the emissions? How can that impact the art?
Yeah, look, I'll just make one thing clear, is the rock art has been there for tens of thousands of years. It was an historical oversight, in reality, that first put industry in the Dampier Archipelago on Murujuga. There is no actual mineral resources in the location. So there isn't really the need to continue to put industry in a place that is clearly of both cultural and natural significance to not only Western Australia but to the whole of Australia and indeed to the whole of humanity. Industry can shift elsewhere. But part of the problem is that apart from the footprint of industry and its impact is the issue of emissions. And we have to date not had satisfactory indication of what is exactly occurring. But we do know from all over the world, in fact, the restorations that were occurring at Notre Dame were in fact in relation to the effects of city emissions on the stones.
My understanding is it's acidity that's affecting the rocks. So if you increase the acidity of the air, then the acid forms on the rock.
Can I just explain a little bit of the chemistry very simply? The Murujuga rock itself was formed billions of years ago, about 3 billion years ago, deep down under extreme pressure. It's an igneous rock, but it's extraordinarily hard. And if you pick up a piece of this rock and drop it on another piece, it sounds like you're dropping metal on metal. This rock doesn't, what we call, exfoliate. It doesn't split off to form soil. So why the Burrup is so beautiful and stark is that it only cracks into big blocks with changes in temperature and doesn't form soil around it. And it was these big flat sides that were beautiful for the Aboriginal people to carve into. But what happens is that those rocks are extraordinarily hard. They do degrade slowly, and over about 30,000 years, it's estimated that you might get a 5 millimetre of what we call a weathering rind. And that weathering rind is yellowish in colour. It's made up of a clay, whereas the base rock is blue-grey, like a battleship. But what's most important is on the outside of that has grown a patina, we call it. It's a very thin layer. It's only at its maximum about 200 microns. Now, a human hair is only 1 micron. And this is very hard. And the carvings and so on were done by breaking through that outer layer, which is very hard and dark red-brown in colour, into the lighter colour underneath, so that you've got both a colour and a contour, a contrast. Now, if you lose that outer patina, it's only at the most about, as I said, 200 microns, then you've lost the rock art. And the really interesting thing is that the way in which this patina has been formed. Now, unfortunately, the research hasn't been done on Murujuga, but there's been similar research done in the Arizona desert in which they show that this outer patina, sometimes called desert varnish, is formed by little microbes that have evolved to live in a very harsh environment. It's an extremely harsh environment. It only rains a few days a year, and the temperatures of the rock will reach up into the 70s and 80 degrees. And yet these little microbes live there. And they're thought that they actually live for hundreds of years, but most of the time they're dormant. And the way they survived is that they secreted acids when the conditions were just right to extract out of the dust manganese and iron and to form a sheath around themselves. So if you look at them, they look like little bunches of red and black grapes sitting on the rock. But most of the time they're dormant. And when they die, they get incorporated into this patina. And the patina grows at the rate of between 1 and 10 microns. That's, you know, a tenth of a human hair in 1,000 years, extraordinarily slowly. But the critical thing is that they only form, the compounds they form, which are manganese and iron oxides and hydroxides, only form at near neutral or alkaline conditions. And we know that if acid forms on it, it does dissolve it. What we don't know is how quickly it is being dissolved on the Burrup Peninsula.
A couple of texts have come through. Linda says, why haven't we fenced this rock art and turned it into a tourist attraction? Good question, Linda. Philip, good morning. You've been up to the Burrup. What did you see? When did you go?
Yeah, I was there in the sort of mid-1990s. I just went, we were in the Pilbara and somebody said, if you go to this area, you'll find something amazing. It was just by chance. And it was just mind-blowing. It was like walking through a valley. It looked like someone dumped a whole lot of flat pieces of rock on top of each other. And it was just covered in rock art. It was just amazing.
When you went into the gorge, did you immediately know what to look for and you saw it? I understand some people are a bit confused when they first go in.
Unless you know what to look for, you don't really notice it because it's quite subtle. But when you start looking, and we actually climbed along the rocks as well. And when you get to the top of the first peak of the rocks, there's like another peak behind it, which you can't see visibly from when you're in the actual valley itself. It's just everywhere. It's completely full of art. It's just incredible.
Peter, on that, when it comes to cultural sensitivities, do people, tourists, know enough about how to treat the art? I'm curious as to whether you think it's a good idea to walk on it or climb on it.
I just want to go back to, I think, a couple of points that Ken made and John as well, and just to say this, that, you know, just to go back to really confirm how important the art is. We don't retouch or redraw new art on the rock. So when the art is gone, it's gone forever. Now, with regards to you know people going into the gorges to have a look at the magnificent rock art that is there, I think one of the things we say quite often to people when they go out there is to respect our culture around not being able to climb on the rocks and walk where you shouldn't go with regards to gender specific matters within the rocks.
So Peter, you're talking about there are rocks that perhaps women shouldn't be looking at?
Yes, there are rocks, like I said, which women shouldn't be looking at, and men as well, and people, who are uninitiated, and so, and the women and the kids.
And how would tourists know that? Is there signage? How can we talk to people and tell people about this?
There isn't any signage, to date. I think what we'll do is once we go down the path of creating a boardwalk down at Deep Gorge, I think we'll put signage where we will restrict access to the public with regards to, the cultural sensitive stuff going forward. But more importantly, I think, what we do is our rangers who patrol the national park that we co-manage on behalf with the Department of Biodiversity and Conservation are out there on a daily basis, talking to, members of the public about, access to the areas.
Rod has called in.
I first went there in the early 60s, and Happy Valley is another area further west of the borough. It's about 6 kilometres west. It's down near the old railway yards, and it's full of rock art, and also what people did, because they couldn't photograph it, they got white paint and painted into some of the images so they could photograph it, and it sort of did away with the actual rock art. But there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of more in that Happy Valley.
Thank you, Rod. Peter, a response to that about people painting on the rock art?
Yeah, listen, I haven't personally witnessed people painting on the rock art, but I think the rock art on the Burrup would have been done initially, with some type of, layout with regards to the final piece, that was put on the individual panels.
Right. And Tom has also called in. Tom, you've spent time living in Karratha. Have you seen the rock art?
I have, yeah. I guess, coming up from down south, what you hear about the Burrup is industry, but, yeah, you get up there and you see the rock art and some of the beaches there, and it's a pretty spectacular landscape, something quite unexpected in that corner of the world.
And so when you're lying at the beach, is it Hearson's Cove?
Yeah, Hearson Cove.
What do you see in here?
It's a stunning beach, but it is a bit disappointing that you do kind of hear the hum of the industry that's pretty much just behind the four dunes there, and you do see these huge industrial plants, and especially at night time when you have the staircase to the moon on, it's quite a remarkable event, but you've got these big lights up in the background, and it's hard to ignore at times.
So Staircase to the Moon, just describe that for people who aren't aware. I think you can also see a similar effect in Broome. What does it look like?
Basically, when the tide goes out at night time and you've got this huge mud flat at Hearson's Cove, and the moon rises, and in the Pilbara it's this nice deep orange moon rises up and creates like a staircase effect along the mud flats right up to the beach where you're sitting.
Right. Thanks for calling in, Tom. And you visited the rock art, obviously. What did you think when you saw it?
Remarkable. I mean, absolutely should be protected. It's probably one of Australia's greatest assets that we don't really pay enough attention to.
Brendan has also called in.
Yeah, I was there when they started the gas, and the crowd that did the pipeline, they just took out a huge area of Eastern's Cove. No consideration for the rock art. But what I find is that, it's everywhere. And Dampier Salt, I don't think they're called Dampier Salt anymore, but on the way out to what's known as Pond Zero in Dampier Salt, there was a magnificent sea eagle carved into a rock. One of the bits that I really remembered was the sea eagle. Absolutely sensational.
So you see the animals on the rocks?
Oh, yeah.
And they tell the stories?
Yeah, and the middens, where the indigenous people used to sit in the caves and eat oysters and things like that, the middens were, metres and metres and metres thick, just huge areas of shell. It's absolutely brilliant. Nobody had to respect. People just go in there, throw their shit everywhere as usual. No respect.
Peter, just on that, tell me a little bit about the importance of the rock art in terms of storytelling from a cultural perspective and the song lines that are expressed through them.
First of all, what I want to do is also put a little bit more of a context around this. We have, as I said before, a national park that we co-manage with the BCA. There is also what we call national heritage values side on the Burrup, and I think one of them is Happy Valley, which fits Tom sort of mentioned previously, and. The rangers, with the assistance of the BCA, Ken from Rio and Woodside as well, have regular contacts whereby we go around and we inspect the sites on a regular basis to ensure that the artist is safe, but more importantly, there's no recent graffiti or that sort of stuff that is also part of having people, as a result of having people wander the gorges and on the hills and that sort of stuff where they sort of are in a position of being out of mind, out of sight, and being able then to create their own art as well.
Luke, you are the manager of government and external relations at Yarra, who has a big plant in the Burrup. Just for people who don't know, what does Yarra do up there?
Sure. So we've got an ammonia plant there, which I guess takes advantage of the supply of gas from the pipeline that comes out of the Woodside plant, and then also take advantage of the existing infrastructure through the Dampier port where we ship our ammonia. And so, I guess we're located, importantly, to understand, we can't build anywhere we like. We're located in a state, a government-mandated industrial estate. So I think one of the things that's come through is, of course, the proximity of that industrial area to the rock art is of concern. That's something of I don't have control over, and that's a decision and a concern for people, which we understand. So I guess what we do have control over is our emissions, etc., and how we operate. And I guess that's where Yarra is doing absolutely everything to ensure that we don't have an impact on the rock art. So, for instance, we spent about $100 million last year in what we call a turnaround, which is ensuring that we've got the most up-to-date, the best control technology. And certainly the State Department of Environment, when they went through our licence and approval, said that we have incorporated the world's best practice.
What are your emissions up there, Luke?
So the main one is CO2. So I can get into a long green tinged discussion, which is interesting.
In a way that people can understand.
Yeah, I'm no chemist. Basically, what we need to do is we take natural gas and take the hydrogen from it. We then use that hydrogen combined with nitrogen from the air and we make ammonia. Now, I'm going to read something that's from Bill Gates, so it's a smarter guy than me, and he says, "The industrial synthesis of ammonia from nitrogen and hydrogen has been of greater fundamental importance to the modern world than the invention of the airplane, nuclear energy, spaceflight or television. And the reason for that is the limit on human growth until we could make, mineral fertiliser or artificial fertiliser was the ability to put dung and fertilise the land. So that's why we're producing the ammonia there. It goes into basically into fertilisers. So our emissions come from the CO2 there. Carbon dioxide is the main one. What we're doing to overcome that, which is a a long story, but we're looking to have a solar farm where we then electrolyse water. So that's going to be a major greening of our operation, which we're currently working on a feasibility study. So, we're confident that what we're doing there is not having an impact. For the last 2 years, we've run very much in partnership with Murujuga, with Peter's Rangers from Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation, the only approved monitoring of the rock art there. And so Ian McLeod, who's a conservation scientist, internationally recognised, his words after those 2 years of comparing his data, he's doing a lot of new work, is, and quoting him, contrary to popular belief, the apparent impact of the tan plant is zip. It's not having any measurable impact on the rock art sites.
And you also work with an archaeologist, Warren Fisher, who monitors the impact. Let's listen to what he has found.
Well, so far we've found that the atmosphere is fairly stable and that it's very difficult to point to any impact on the rock art by industry. But of course, these studies need to continue, and we're actually working on some quite interesting new technology today that will give us a better insight into what may be occurring on the rocks or not.
So, John and Ken, your response to that? John, we'll start with you.
Yes, look, our CO2 is a big output there, but that's of very little concern to the rock art itself. What we know is that patina, that outer layer, that desert varnish that is essential for preservation of the rock art, is dissolved once the pH starts to fall. Once acidity rises, pH falls. And it was good that Luke mentioned Ian McLeod, because Ian McLeod has done a lot of work there over the years. And what he has shown is that the pH of the rock, and this is standard for rocks in that type of desert environment, is very, very close to neutral. And he showed that earlier, before industry, the rocks were had a pH of 6.8, which is very close to neutral. And that over time, and particularly the output of nitrogen dioxide from both the Yarra plant now, but previously a lot of it from the Woodside plant, has reduced or increased the acidity, reduced the pH by a huge extent. And at some places it's been measured just recently as low as 3.8, which is a 1,000 times increase in acidity. And so what this does is actually start to dissolve that outer layer. And in theory, we know that at that level of pH, it is being dissolved, but we don't know at what rate. There's another little important consideration that needs to go in here, and that is that pH is a measure of hydrogen ion plus and hydrogen ion minus in a ratio. And the thing that's critical is the amount of acid, not necessarily that it's there. And unfortunately, those studies haven't really been done to know what the amount is.
But you're working on another study, aren't you? Analysing the rock, will that give you some findings?
Yeah, look, there's a couple of really important things here. One thing we need to know is what is the deposition of acid actually on the rock surface itself. And the last published measures that were made in that area were back in 2006 and 2008 by a good CSIRO study. But I understand that during that measurement, Ken, that the fertilizer plant wasn't operating, so it was just the Woodside plant.
Ken?
John's correct in that when those measurements were taken, several of the major operations that are there today weren't functioning at that time. But in a simple perspective, some of that rock art has been there, survived for tens of thousands of years, some for hundreds of years. We now have a situation where, regardless of the level of industrial emissions and their effects, we're in a circumstance that did not exist over the time the rock art was present. But for the last 20 years, there have been emissions. And, in fact, Luke is correct in that Yarra established because that's where they were told to establish. So the government really has to start looking at this place not as an industrial hub, it as a cultural precinct and start putting industry elsewhere, and certainly regulating emissions, and by putting in filters, cutting down the emissions from those plants will alleviate some of the circumstances.
And we'll move on to future development in just a moment. Morning, John.
Luke, all the amelioration work that you do in for the environment, does that get paid for by you, or is it a tax offset, which means that the Australian people pay for these for all the environmental work you do, and you actually get a free kick? Is that correct?
Luke?
Well, yeah, we do pay for it, but I guess that would be a business expense. It wouldn't be something that we'd cost out separately somehow. It's a cost of operating, is to make sure that we're looking after the environment, if that's what you mean. But we don't then go back to the government and ask for some other money. We actually contribute to the rock art monitoring program whilst it was in existence by the WA government. And in the last 2 years, we've funded our own rock art monitoring program with independent experts that were approved by the Commonwealth Environment Minister, which was fully at Yara's expense.
Hope that answers your question, Luke. A few texts coming in. Murujuga is spectacular, and what we have lost too much of, and we've lost too much of it already. I'm very grateful for all those people who are protecting what remains. This is a remarkable place, and if we lose any more of it, future generations will be appalled at our lack of understanding of its global significance. And that's from Dell, who lived in Karratha for a number of years and never tired of the magnificence of the Burrup Peninsula and the amazing artworks it contained. Kent has also texted in. The art is precious and must be treated as precious, but without the natural resources WA draw from the area, we will be broke in no time. We have nothing else, no manufacturing, nothing. There will have to be sensible and sensitive compromises. And that's what this conversation is about. How can the rock art coexist with industry? Because I don't think it's reasonable to think that industry is going to move. Let's look at future developments. Now, last year, a leaked memo revealed the McGowan government is considering approval for two major industrial projects located on the Burrup that you've mentioned briefly, Ken. So a consortium led by Wesfarmers is proposing a $1.4 billion methanol plant. There's another site earmarked for a $4.3 billion plant by a fertiliser producer. Should there be further developments? I'll go to you, Peter.
Yes, Murujuga's public position on this has always been that all future developments we would like to see move to the Maitland Estate, which is further south of the Burrup.
So you're happy for there to be further development, but in that southern estate?
Yes.
On the mainland is right. Where Maitland Estate is. Away from the rock art is the idea. No one is saying we shouldn't stop industrial processing going on, but there is no reason for it to continue within the Burrup. And as Yarra would have found out, the hardness of the rock means it is very expensive to develop on that property. And in fact, Pluto, to solve that situation with their development, actually brought in rock and dumped over the top rather than try and bulldoze the rocks flat. And in fact, that's the case with the town of Dampier that was built by Hammersley Iron back in the 60s. They did exactly the same, using dredge fill to level the ground. It is not a sensible place to build, let alone the fact that it is a place of cultural significance and of deep religious significance to the Aboriginal people.
And do you have concerns that future development might have an impact on the UNESCO bid?
We know that Australia is in perilous situation with all its World Heritage nominations because of the way we put at risk, like the Barrier Reef, like the Tasmanian Wilderness Area, and in fact even Kakadu when the uranium mine was operating within its area, that Australia is being looked at unfavourably by the international organisation because we don't seem to be able to protect what we nominate for World Heritage. And in this case, if a place is a threat, it is not accepted. It will not be accepted. So obviously further putting industry on the Burrup by the state government when they're saying they value the cultural heritage significance of this place and are preparing nomination for World Heritage does place it at risk.
We did put a request in for an interview with Minister for Environment Stephen Dawson and got a statement. The government's saying the Perdaman and Coogee proposals are an opportunity for more jobs in the Pilbara, and they're confident projects such as these can coexist with heritage. Peter?
I would agree with Minister Dorsman's statement. I mean, we've, you know, you look at history now. I think we've coexisted on the Burrup now, you know, for a very long time. It's just a matter of sitting down and having, you know, those hard, honest discussions about how we assist with regards to the emission and the protection and the preservation of our rock art.
And just to finish up, where is the World Heritage listing at? I understand it's a very long process. Peter, you met with the Premier on Friday. What did you discuss?
Yes, I met with the Premier on Friday, and it was regards to another funding announcement. But with regards to the World Heritage announcement, we made the announcement to progress with the World Heritage in August last year. We've since formed two committees, an interagency task force and a heritage committee made up of my board members. We are hoping to put a submission, developing a submission for consideration by the Commonwealth to register with UNESCO by the 1st of February 2020, and then it'll be a matter of us sitting down with the state government and working on providing a more comprehensive dossier for the World Heritage process.
So you send it to the Commonwealth and then they put the bid into UNESCO?
Yes, basically the state sent it to the Commonwealth and the Commonwealth lodged the application on behalf of the state.
And just finally, you mentioned you met with the Premier to talk about another project. What's that?
It's to do with some funding to the tune of 1.3 mil for our Living Knowledge Centre, which we going to construct at a place called Konzink Bay on the Burrup. This we believe will also complement our World Heritage aspirations, but I think more importantly it will also provide an opportunity for our members around some employment, training and business opportunities, but it will also be a centre, I think, where we can showcase our cultural heritage, not only to the local people here in Karratha, but I think to the world as well, and show them what an absolutely fantastic place the Burrup or Murujuggera is.
Thank you so much to Ken Mulvaney, Luke Blackburn, Dr. John Black and Peter Jeffries for joining this conversation about the Burrup Peninsula. And we'll finish off with a song this morning from up there, Nandu Nara, and it's by a local Nullumar man. Hope you enjoy it.
The stone, their eyes are watching you as you pass on by. Down on the Nullumar, lowland, coastal plains. This is my land.